Well, if you've lost Mark 10, do please find it again. We're in verse 32 through to verse 45. I think we may ask the question, how many times do you have to say something in order to be understood? Many a parent may have been heard to express some such thought or question. How many times do I have to tell you to do this? But there's a deeper issue, isn't there, sometimes? How many times do you have to say something in order to be properly understood, especially if it's something which takes people by surprise? And probably the number of times you need to say it may depend on the seriousness of what it is that you're saying. Now, in verses 32 to 34 in Mark chapter 10, we find Jesus saying for the third time, though he may have said it more often than that, but it's recorded here in Mark's very short gospel record. This is the third time Jesus is recorded as explaining what is going to happen. We are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. Jesus is recorded as saying this in chapter 8 and in chapter 9 and in chapter 10, and every time it seems the disciples simply do not get it, and they won't get it until considerably later when looking back the other side of the cross and the empty tomb of Jesus, and then they understand what it is that he was saying. Every time this is recorded, this a little paragraph like this, after each of the three times, Mark then records very radical teaching of Jesus, which follows the basic statement that he's heading to the cross. Every single time, what he says is then followed by radical teaching and by showing that the disciples simply aren't thinking on the same lines that he is. So I want to look this morning under just these two headings on the verses that follow. What does Jesus tell us about the way of the world on the one hand and his way on the other? And we'll see they are absolutely and totally and radically different. And we'll begin by thinking about the way of the world, the normal way in which normal everyday people think. And the values of the world, what you might call the way of the world, are well demonstrated by these two disciples, James and John, the sons of Zebedee. They may be in the band of disciples, as indeed they are. They've been called along with the other 10. They are there in that sense physically with Jesus, but their attitudes, their values are no different from anyone else's. And if we ask what matters to them, two things very simply, self and status. Self and status. And self is seen in verse 35. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." What do you make of that? "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." It is so awful, it's superb. It is utterly, totally brazen. I mean, you could not really have a more blatant statement, could you, of "me first," that old cry that's been on our lips since we were old enough to speak. "Me first. We want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." They want a blank check in which they can write whatever they want, and all Jesus has to do is to sign it. And that is the deal. And this is not a spontaneous request. They have come up to him together, and they say it together. So this isn't a sort of sudden thing that's just come from nowhere. This is calculated, a deep-seated attitude. You can imagine the behind-hand, just sort of stepping behind the others for a little bit and saying to each other, "What can we ask for Jesus? Do you think if we just slip in ahead of Matthew and Judas and Peter and the others, we can probably jump the queue and then you know, we'll get what we want? Because after all, we're the best ones, aren't we, really?" Well, that's the attitude. And at least it's right to this extent that they believe that Jesus is able to do whatever they ask. So to that extent, they're right. He is, after all, the Messiah, and they have confidence in him, and they are determined politely that he will do it, and they cannot see that he would have any problem with that request. It is brazen and laughable in its awfulness. And Jesus replies, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they reply, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." So along with self, their concern is for status. And again, to this extent, they've got it right. They know that Jesus will be in glory. They probably don't understand that rightly, but they know that where he is heading. And their assumption is that it will be for him an easy ride. It'll be an easy ride to glory for him, and therefore it should be an easy ride to glory for them. They expect the Messiah to triumph and to triumph gloriously. They say to him, "You're heading for the top position, and what better company could you have there than ours?" That's what it is. Reminds us, if you know the story of Esther in the Old Testament, and King Ahasuerus asks the question of his right-hand man, his prime minister, Haman. The king says to Haman, "What do you think is suitable? What would you do for the person whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman says, "Who could the king possibly want to honor more than me?" And it's that attitude here. We could not, Jesus obviously would choose us. What better company could he have than ours? Now these two guys, James and John, remember they are the sons of Zebedee. Zebedee's home was, as we would think of it, a sort of middle-class home. And they have given up some middle-class security because their dad has a fishing business. And they have given up that status of being in quite a comfortable little home, but they think therefore they should be rewarded with a higher one. And when we hear that they want to be sitting at Jesus' right hand, we may assume that they're not sitting on the floor. He is on a throne, and they expect to be on a throne as well. I can imagine them dreaming, eyes shut, picturing this glorious scene with Jesus in the center, one on the right and one on the left. Now these attitudes, the concern for self and the desire for status, are, as we know, deeply embedded in human nature. And some people, the desire for status is the one which is very strong, probably a particular danger for those in the public eye. And Jesus recognizes that when he says in verse 42, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. That is the way of the world." It said of the Sun King, Louis XIV of France, that whenever he walked down a corridor, any servants who happened to be there had to turn and face the wall so that they might not meet the king's eye, or he might not have to look at them as he passed. That is the attitude of the world. Those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great ones exercise authority. And for even for us who do not own palaces and so on, our significance can often be thought of as coming from the number of people under us, the number of people who have to do what we say, the number of people whom we can boss around and provide status. Or it may come differently from the number of Facebook friends we have or would like to have. Or in a celebrity culture like ours, maybe the number of followers that an individual can lay claim to in social media. So for some, status is tremendously important. Not everyone is taken up with status, though, by any means. But self-centeredness, that is the default position of all of us, even though we show it in different ways. And the fact that it's the default position of all of us is shown by the reaction of the other disciples. Because when, in verse 41, the other 10 disciples hear what the first two have been up to, they get very cross indeed. So they all want the same thing. James and John are brazen in asking for it. And the other 10 say, "Well, why should they have it?" So they all want the same thing. When we were looking at Mark chapter 8, and Jesus is called there to deny self and take up the cross and follow. I just mentioned a Christian leader who was trying to explain what this meant to a young American who couldn't quite see it. And The leader explained that actually following Jesus means getting out of the center of life, getting out of the driving seat of the car and moving into the passenger seat and letting Jesus move into the center. And he was explaining this to the young man whose brow became increasingly furrowed until he said, as you remember, "Gee, I guess I'm not too keen on this decentralization." And that is the issue, isn't it? None of us is keen on decentralization. And these 12 disciples haven't even begun, as their attitudes to each other show. Now, they may think they have, because in some measure they have signed up with Jesus. They've associated themselves with him. They are following him. But they haven't begun to rewrite their own agenda. And people today can make a similar mistake. They can be in church sometimes, maybe in church often, might call themselves Christian and assume they are in, as it were, but have never really let go of central place, never really surrendered control to Jesus, still where the 12 are at, with self at the center. So that is the way of the world, concern for self, concern for status, and all 12 disciples, not just the brazen two at the front, are marked by it. What then, by contrast, is the way of Jesus? Well, as you would expect, it could hardly be more different. And I notice here the extraordinary gentleness, the patience, and the humility in the way that she handles these men with their childlike squabbles and their jockeying for position. They may be grown men, but it is just childish, isn't it? And how childish we adults can be. So they come to him and say, "Teacher, we want." And he says, "What is it that you want me to do for you?" Maybe he's asking that with a kindly smile as to children. Now, he could have rounded on them, couldn't he? Such a ridiculous and inappropriate thing to say. But he just says, "What is it that you want me to do for you?" And then they say, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." And he just says, "Oh, you don't understand, do you? You do not know what you are asking." He is the teacher. And his worry is that they don't get it. They do not understand. And he goes on to say, actually, it's not in fact for me to say who sits at my right hand and my left in my glory. What extraordinary humility there is in that reply of Jesus. To sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant. This is the Son of God speaking. But he seems to have no trouble in deferring to the Father in heaven about something that affects him so personally. So his own way of dealing with these childish adults models his own way of patience and humility and kindness and service. Because his way is not the way of self and status. His way is the way of suffering and of service. And those are the contrasts that we find. And they're seen, the suffering that is there in Jesus' way, seen in the references to the cup and to baptism. In verse 38, Jesus says, not only you don't know what you're asking, he asks a question, "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? Are you able to be?" And the cup here is the cup of suffering. That's what he's referring to. And he says, "Are you able to drink of it?" And they say, "Oh, yes," breezily. And they are right. They will drink of that cup of suffering in following Jesus, but they have little idea what they're saying. It won't be a very long time before James loses his head in the early days of the early church. They will share in the cup, but they don't understand what that means. And the baptism with which he will be baptized. It takes the same idea, but it adds this dimension of being overwhelmed, like the person who is pushed down into the river or into the baptismal pond, submerged for a while in water. And the idea of Jesus being baptized has got nothing here to do with water. It's to do with the tsunami, the overwhelming experience of the cross and the abandonment by the Father. when he's praying a little later in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow, even unto death." Now this cup, this baptism, they will share in if they are faithful followers of his. It will always be the way, and it is a privilege. It's not a mistake. It's not an accident. It's just how things are going to be. So Paul writes to the Philippian church a number of years later, "It has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer with him for his sake." Now that is how it was for Jesus. His way is the way of suffering, and in lesser or greater measure, it will be so for the faithful followers of Jesus, not out of some strange desire to suffer, but out of a desire to be faithful to him. And there's an old Christian poem which puts it this way: "Can he have followed far who has no wound, no scar?" So the way of Jesus that he points them to here is not the way of instant glory, it's the way of suffering. Suffering at the hands of a world which is hostile to the things of God. And the opposition to Jesus doesn't start at the time of his arrest. It's there from the beginning. The shadow of the cross hangs over the whole gospel record. And it's the way in which his followers are to walk. Suffering then, for one thing. And secondly, service. Suffering and service. You see, according to Jesus, that marvelously brazen request needs to be turned inside out and upside down. Instead of asking for a blank check from Jesus, the follower is to present Jesus with a blank check and allow him to write in it whatever he will wish. Not, "Lord, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you," but, "Lord, here am I to do for you whatever you ask of me." It's very simple, really, but it's very, very radical. And that, of course, is the attitude of Jesus to his Father. "Lo, I've come to do your will, O God." And he says to the disciples, "I always do what is pleasing to him." And as Jesus always did what was pleasing to the Father, so the Christian says to Jesus, "Lord, here am I to do for you whatever you ask of me." How do you find that this morning? That's what we're about if we're Christian. And it's a privilege to be able to say that. John the Baptist, at the beginning of the Gospel, doesn't have many of his words recorded, but he does say of Jesus, "One is coming after me, the thong of whose sandals I'm not worthy to untie." Now, if you go down to the shoe shop in the middle of town and you're trying on a pair of shoes, and may well be the helper will just help you and actually do up the shoelace if you're finding it difficult, then you won't think that's a particularly remarkable thing. It's just what you'd expect in a shoe shop. But in the culture of the day, this was the lowest possible task. This was something that only the slave would do. Untying and doing up shoes was the lowest task of the low. And John the Baptist says, "I am not worthy to untie the sandals of Jesus." The humblest slave's task is something of which I am not fit to do. It is a privilege I do not deserve. So student helpers on summer camps, on which a lot of our folk go, can sometimes be surprised to be told at the beginning of the camp that cleaning the toilets for Jesus is a privilege they don't deserve. That's the reality. Every now and again, eyebrows go up when being told this. But that's the mentality of the servant. And Jesus, of course, himself embodies both these things, both the suffering and the service, to the highest possible extent, both in the suffering that he endured and in the service that he performed. Now today is Remembrance Sunday, and we do of course remember with thanks those who gave their lives for us and for our sake and for our freedom. So many of them, too many to list. We do remember with thanks, and yet in the light of that, people sometimes say, well, lots of people have given their lives, so what is so special about Jesus giving his life? He's just one of many. To which the answer comes in verse 45, where Jesus says, "The Son of Man," that's himself, "came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." to give his life as a ransom. The cup of suffering in his case had this added dimension of being the cup of God's wrath, which on the cross he drank to its dregs, so that you and I might never have to face it. That is unique to Jesus. And we must understand that there is a vast gap between his sacrifice and even the noblest sacrifice undertaken since then by anyone else. It is only his sacrifice that pays our ransom, that opens the gate of heaven, and sets the prisoner free. Lord, here am I to do for you whatever you ask of me. I wonder why the rubber hits the road for you and me. Probably on a much lesser scale, but a very real one nevertheless, because the cross of Jesus is a pattern as well as a sacrifice. It is an example for us to follow if we walk in his way. Jesus says to us, the world's concern is with self and status, but in that very pregnant little phrase, verse 43, it shall not be so among you. Rather, whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. I wonder where that fits with us. It has been said that the church can look sometimes like little else than a religious version of the world. So the only difference between churchgoers and non-churchgoers is precisely that one lot go to church and the other lot don't. And other than that, they're indistinguishable, which is very, very sad and tragic when it's true, because the whole mentality of Christian people is to be radically different. That's what Jesus is saying. It's not a question of sticking on a few good deeds without any change of heart. I was a scout, actually. In those days, we were called Boy Scouts. And our scoutmaster's favorite phrase was, do your good deed for the day. And apparently one was enough, picking up a piece of litter, and you could then feel pleased you'd done your good deed. And of course, the whole mentality of the Christian way is radically different, far more than sticking on a few good deeds with no change of heart. And the thing that does change the heart is the recognition and the awareness that he, the Son of Man, has done something utterly unique and wonderful when he gave his life as a ransom for many, which means a ransom for me. Where does this hit the road for you and me? Well, it's lovely to see it hitting the road constantly within our life at St. John's, as I do time and again. So I think of someone offering to help with the sound desk at the back on a Sunday, and I say to him, oh, I didn't know, are you good at this? Is your gift? He says, no, I've never done it, actually, but I was just looking for somewhere to serve. It's great. Think of somebody helping out with the teenage group for a whole year, not because it was really her gift, but because she saw that there was a need, and she was free, and she thought she'd try to meet it. Think of musicians rehearsing for a Sunday morning and faced with a song that they really do not like, but laying aside personal preference and leading that song with gusto for the sake of everybody else. I think of another person saying, well, I'm not really an upfront sort of person at all, but I can arrange flowers. And that's a gift that I can use to make the church attractive and welcoming as people come. Service is so often seen in these smaller ways, isn't it? Not in the sort of big dramatic gestures necessarily. So often seen in the smaller ways, though often, of course, it isn't seen at all, except from heaven. And if we serve one another within the body of Christ, we also serve unbelievers for Jesus' sake. It's what he asks of us. And that, again, is our privilege. It gives credibility to our gospel message. A very necessary credibility. And it can have very lovely effects precisely because it is so different from the way of the world. We often quote 2 Corinthians 4, what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, which is wonderful. But there's a second half to the verse, with ourselves as your servants for the sake of Jesus. So I think, why were our friends across the road at Junaki's looking forward to the men's curry night the other Friday? Why were they looking forward to bringing across curry for 120 men? partly, I guess, because it was quite a profitable thing to do, but also because they knew from past experience that the people, the women helping in the kitchen, are so thoughtful and so helpful to them and stay to the end and smile and are servant-hearted. I think of an engaged couple with no church background at all, arriving at their own request, coming for marriage preparation, and amazed that a Christian home is opened to them week after week with lovely meals prepared and nothing being too much trouble. And I think, why? What's going on here? Well, it's just the way of Jesus. I think of an older person whose work means she often mingles with many very famous people, but who cares every bit as much for the person who brings the coffee and cleans the table. And that person knows it. And I think of a young girl in Thailand, whom Julie was telling us about this week, selling fruit and vegetables from her little market stall, forcefully preached at by Jehovah's Witnesses, but actually won for Christ by a Christian girl who gave her time and who listened and got to know her and understood her and her life and her concerns. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all.